the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, you're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Jacob Parks is the President of Strategy for Profitable Ideas Exchange, or APIE, a business development team that advises professional service firms. A Gonzaga MBA, Jacob is also the author of Never Say Sell, a guide to how professional firms expand their business with key clients, and a new book anticipated early next year on managing the growth function in professional services firms.
Good. What's happening, man? How are you?
Fantastic, although this weather, something else. I was just complaining about the weather, 104 or something today, right? It's absolutely ridiculous. I'm playing golf this afternoon like an idiot.
Oh, you're playing golf today? Oh, wow.
Well, not till 5 o'clock, but still too hot.
I did a pickleball, a 6:30 a.m. pickleball session. It was getting hot towards the end, so.
Where do you play pickleball?
We played up at Comstock. I love being outside. Wherever I get a game, man. So good. How are you doing?
Fantastic. Yeah,
doing great. Yeah, thanks for joining us. Excited to do some catch up. It's been a long time. And I'm actually really excited to talk about your book that's coming out, but we'll get to that in due time. Okay. So this is a Zag Business Podcast. Simple formula here, man. We're going to talk about you. Of course, I'm the youngest child, so eventually everything comes back to me, the focus on me.
Well, I am too, so that'll be an interesting
Yeah, right. Awesome. But take me from the beginning. Spokane kid, as far as I know. I know where you went to high school, but what was happening before that?
So I grew up in Spokane my whole life. I actually grew up out in Hilliard. So I went to St. Patrick's Elementary School.
Wow.
Rest in peace, St. Patrick's, unfortunately. It was always so sad. This is a random aside, a Spokane thing, but I was so sad when like St. Patrick's closed, but there are so many Catholic schools on the north side compared to the South Hill. It sort of makes sense. This is totally a business podcast after all, that there should be some consolidation of those enterprises out there. But it's still sad. So yeah, a Hilliard kid, my whole life, my whole family's been in Hilliard for multiple generations, less wow. so now, but like my grandma went to St. Patrick's. My mother went to St. Patrick's. Obviously, my brother and I went to St. Patrick's. So, yeah. So that actually was interesting. Coming to prep, I didn't have a lot of friends, didn't know a lot of people. It's like a little bit of a unique experience coming to prep. And, you know, you might expect that to be rough. And it was awesome. I mean, I found prep to be so welcoming and such a great experience, which is not always, you know, the case for kids coming from Hilliard to like a private school like that.
Right. South Hill heavy and I guess deep north heavy students going there. So, exactly. Yeah, interesting. I didn't realize you were from the yard, man. Tons of respect, man. This is unreal. And I think St. Patrick's now is a Catholic high school.
Yeah, like affiliated with Mount St. Michael's maybe, right?
I don't know. I think it's called Chesterton Academy. I don't think it's associated with Mount St. Michael's because that's kind of like an offshoot of Catholicism. I think there's a Pope up there or something like that. But
Mount St. Michael's?
Yeah. Yeah. The Jesuits sold it to this group. I think they're based in Omaha. And that's where the Singing Nuns are from.
Yeah.
Who are awesome. But I don't think my understanding is, and I should know more about this given my current role at Gonzaga, but they are not in alignment with the Vatican. So it's like, I think they do a Latin mass up there. It's like pre-Vatican II kind of stuff.
We used to sneak up there when we were kids and mess around and try to see what was happening because it felt very mysterious and like, you know, skulls kind of thing, like a secret society to us. So we used to look around every now and again.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful facility. And there's a Jesuit cemetery. That's where the Jesuit cemetery is at. So, they kept that plot of land, but yeah, that was Father Cataldo built that place. And I think before Gonzaga.
It's a great piece of property, great view. And
yeah. And I hear stories of like, and this would be like your dad or grandma's generation, but there was a baker at the bottom of the hill that would, you know, bake loaves and bring them up in the morning for all the students. I mean, I think you lived there and they grew their own food. They grew Gonzaga's food at one point. like for the cafeteria. This is way back when. This doesn't matter. That's not what we're here talking about.
It's fascinating. I've never heard any of this.
Yeah, yeah.
We used to go up and hoop against them as kids.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's on the internet, so it must be true. So that's what I'll say. So anyway, okay. So St. Patrick's kid, that's amazing. Make your way to prep, and you know, I mean, you had full disclosure for folks that are for the six folks that are listening. I'm a year ahead of Jacob at prep, graduate. You make your way to Montana State, if I'm correct, right?
Yep, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you're at Montana State, you're out there in beautiful Bozeman, studying business, I assume, on some level. And then what happens next?
So you're right. I went to MSU. I went actually with a good friend of mine, Mike Wilson, from prep. So we were roommates at MSU, which was trouble. And then, so I'm at MSU, and like about year three, I'm working as a mason, right? Because I'm trying to put my way through school. So I'm working as a mason.
Wow. Okay.
So one of the crazy things that happened in my life, the summer between junior and senior year, got this masonry job. And so we go down to this job that we have in West Yellowstone. We spend the summer in West Yellowstone. And we start working on this person's house. And I'm like, who is this person? It's like a 15,000 square foot house. And it turns out it's Stephen Covey. And so I get to know Stephen Covey because I'm working on his home. And like, he comes out, I've still got the signed book on my shelf from Stephen Covey, but he comes out with popsicles and says, I just had my 52nd grandchild. He's got all these grandchildren. Anyhow, just a wild experience. But about that time when I went back to college for my senior year, given my background and now you know about it, I was like, if I don't figure something out, I'm going to be a mason for the rest of my life. Like, I got to get some sort of real sit down at a desk experience. And so this guy, his name was Harry Wallace, was like substitute teaching a class about sales. We're going to come back to sales classes. And so he was this East Coast guy, you know, he would stand up there and talk about how human everything was because he can't say an H. And I found him to be fascinating because at MSU, there's a lot of what I might call lifestyle professors who move to Bozeman because it's beautiful and because they can get a gig and have a little professional life, but also be skiing and fishing on the weekends. And I was just enamored with this guy because he had run business development for Arthur Andersen. And he had a lot of like interesting stories that he had told about his experience. And so I approached him after class and I said, can I have an internship on this new thing you're starting? And he promptly told me no. So that didn't work out. And so then like 2 months later, we were doing some like marketing class where we were raffling off a car. And so I called him up and I pitched him a raffle ticket and he bought it. And he said, why don't you come in and start an internship too? He's like, if you're cold calling me to sell me $100 or nothing, you can come work for me. And so I got the internship my senior year. So January of my senior year, I stopped being a mason. Most of the time I did some masonry work on the side still to pay bills because I went from making good money to making $7 an hour at this internship. But I knew I had to kind of switch gears a little bit. Right. So I did this internship and then I've literally been at this company for 21 years. We bought the founder out. We did a leverage buyout, management team leverage buyout a few years ago. And so we bought the company from the founder. And here I am, you know, 21 years later doing the same gig. But anyhow, that's a little bit of the story.
So what's the company do?
So the company's called Profitable Ideas Exchange. We go by PIE. Our founder named it, not me. Our focus is all things professional services, business development. So basically, a lot of people don't know this, but up until 1979, there was a prohibition on direct solicitation for accounting businesses or for legal businesses. Like all they could do was accept business, list themselves in the phone book, but they couldn't like market. And so when that changed, Harry became the first person to lead business development for Arthur Andersen and started to formalize a bunch of the kind of modern techniques. Interestingly enough, he tried to hire a bunch of salespeople, like technology salespeople, and it failed miserably because I think our belief is that the seller-doer model, where the consultant who has the expertise wins the work, is like a preferred model. And so from there, they built this thing called FAST, Focus Accelerated Solutions Team. But it was basically the birth of community marketing where I'll just give you an example. Like I'm sure a lot of your students go to KPMG because you all have a wonderful accounting program. So KPMG has a tax practice. They want to serve chief tax officers. And so in an environment like that, the way that we would help them is we would build them a program of all of the sort of Fortune 250 chief tax officers, put them on peer group calls, invite them to events, do a bunch of different kind of community building with them. And KPMG uses that kind of program as an opportunity to listen, understand the problems, and then, you know, win work in a way that feels bespoke, that doesn't feel like you're just going out there and rapid fire machine gunning all the services you have, but actually being responsive to client needs. And so we do a bunch of other stuff like audits and training and, you know, account planning work for people, segmentation work. But our bread and butter is building community on behalf of expert service firms.
And he came up with this, when would you say, because I'm seeing a lot more of this today, and I'll talk a little about some stuff we're trying to do at Gonzaga, but was this before your time or kind of like, I guess, right? So basically he's starting right when you're coming in as an intern.
He's starting this business, but the creation of this thesis started at Anderson when I was probably at Prep or perhaps even St. Pat's.
Gotcha. A couple of years before you were on the market.
That's right.
So that's incredible. And my understanding is, and I don't know if you call it the soft sell or what, but it's really more about relationship building from what I've seen. And, hey, we're here for you. If you need something, here's what we can do or whatever. And as you say, maybe listening to the client, because I get invited to these every once in a while, whether it's an insurance company or getting people together and we'll give you a free meal. Maybe some free continuing education. Is that kind of the concept?
Yep, that's exactly right. And I think if I can just like drill down on it, one of the things we found is like they actually want to learn from each other. One of the biggest questions we get from our clients every time is like, how are you going to get these executives there? And it's like, if we just promise to let them talk to each other, if you let CFOs talk to CFOs, they will show up for that because it's lonely and it's fearful at the top. Like, the feedback, there's this great book Michael Lewis did. I think it's called The Undoing Project, about these Israeli psychologists. And basically what he's saying is we mitigate risk. We don't seize opportunity. And they do all these cool studies to determine that we actually are more programmed to mitigate risk. And so interestingly, we see the same exact dynamic in our executives. They come to make sure they're not missing something. They're not looking for some great idea or some corporate secret. They're making sure they're not missing some big thing on cyber that's going to have them hauled in front of the board and in trouble. And it's hard to talk with anybody else in the organization besides your peers at other similar sized companies.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So an executive in residence who had a career in Manhattan, investment banking, he did M&A work for Wells and Deutsche, and they would do this. And he's kind of brought this model to Gonzaga, but with the idea that let's bridge the gap between what's going on at Jepson Center on Boone Avenue and downtown, or even like the greater community. That's part of what this podcast actually gets towards. His comment was, you know, these are the conversations sometimes that you can have when maybe HR is not in the room, or the honest conversations, I should say, right? In the non-guarded conversations. So Interesting. So you guys are facilitating that for clients, basically.
Yep. And we agree, by the way, like we start every single call with, this call is governed by the Chatham House rule, which is to say, use what you hear, but there is never attribution to an individual or a company. Every single call starts that way because it has to be that way, because every now and again, they do say something that's not like you're going to get on CNN for, but stuff that they wouldn't want out there.
Right. Right.
Layoffs, bad company performance, whatever it might be, but stuff they're not trying to broadcast effectively.
Right. And sometimes it's just hard to articulate things the right way, and you want to be able to speak freely.
Exactly.
So you're an intern, you're working your way up, and now you're the president and CEO, right?
No, we have a CEO. I'm the president, so we kind of do two in a box. Yep.
Okay. So 21 glorious years, you know, learning the biz, and you guys serve clients all over the country?
International.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
International base. Yeah. I mean, we don't do all that much work in APAC, but some work in APAC and then a fair bit of work in Europe.
How do you, did you go to Florence? No,
I went to Australia with Riggs Kubiak.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So you and Riggs went to, okay. Awesome. because I know Wilson went to Florence the year after. So tell me some of the things you have to navigate culturally when you're doing client from Luxembourg or whatever, Korea. Do you have to make some adjustments to kind of meet whatever their cultural norms are when you're talking about facilitating these communities?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that anything from language preferences, like I'm sure you know, in the sort of French part of Canada, there's like actually a prohibition against doing business in English. And wow. So we have a few people who speak French who can kind of help out in those areas. I think, interestingly enough, one of the things we see in Western Europe is a proclivity toward in-person meetings as opposed to virtual meetings, which I think is one cultural, but I think it's also part of the geography. Okay. Like stuff is close and you can get on a train and go meet someone pretty easily versus like getting from Cleveland to LA is a full day operation. And so we are more comfortable, I think, with virtual. Early on, before Zoom, we did all these by conference call. And one of the things we found is that sometimes we had to temper the US participants when we had a joint call with international participants because we can be a bit brash and loud. And so like making sure to carve space for the Europeans to weigh in or for the folks from Australia or from China to weigh in was really important because they just tend to be a little bit more polite than US citizens. And so we had to like structure conversation to make sure they were participating or else they wouldn't return. So things like that are absolutely sort of part of the norm.
Interesting. Yeah, I did, before I came to academia, I did some international tax at Deloitte. And I loved just the cultural background that was always lingering when you had different folks on the call and navigating that. And I think that was born in part, curiosity born of my studying abroad. I went to Florence, obviously. So, okay, very cool.
Wait, are you teaching in Florence ever? Like, that's the dream gig for all of us, right?
Like, I am.
My wife and I went to Florence for 3 months. Like, she went to Florence. She went to Little Marymount, but she went to Florence with Gonzaga, like everybody does in our community. And then she loved it, obviously, and I wanted to check it out. So we spent 3 months there in 2017.
At the front door.
I just worked there, which was great. Like you can kind of work like a noon to eight schedule, get a late dinner, sleep in. Like it's a good lifestyle for sure. Wow. So I love the city. Amy's my wife's name. We always talk about like, how do I get the teaching in Florence gig? I'll do it for free. But you are getting that gig sometimes.
So I have not gone yet. I am scheduled for spring semester 2025. So I'll be around till about the end of the year. Got two sons, 5 and 8, and I think we're just trying to figure out what their schedule will be. I mean, maybe they come over for a month and come back for a month and then come over for a month. It's a 4 month assignment.
Yep.
So we'll see. A lot of details to be worked out, but I mean, I got the work visa and that's the other challenge, right? You only get 3 months if you're on a tourist visa. But yeah, I'm excited. It's a heavy lift because they're new classes, new preps. But I mean, there's also, I think, a recognition that a lot of your education is happening outside of the classroom when you're studying in Florence. So
I feel like that's the case. Like I went on study abroad and I didn't go to class very frequently and I learned more in that experience than any other semester, probably.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. And Australia is awesome too. So yeah, but the plan is to go there, just kind of working out the details. So. But we're excited. And I've been told by colleagues who have done it, and they're like, this is the greatest gift you can give your kids is to expose them to that, you know, and I just think of my 8-year-old, you know, and girls are coming on the scene and there's a lot of, you know, and it's like, this will be good for you to kind of get away and see that not everything's happening at Wilson Elementary in Spokane, you know, so.
But a lot is.
Right. So. Yeah, so to get the gig, obviously not my arena, but Florence is a very different program than when we went through, and I know you didn't go through, but we used to go for the full year. Higher ed changed a ton.
Wait, is it more of a semester program now?
It's a semester program now. And your wife, I wonder when she went, she might have been in the old facility at the Palazzo Antinori.
Nope, she was in the... They were either the last class in or the first class out because I remember talking about that transition.
Okay. Yeah. There's some crazy stories about that transition. They're up in San Marco now. It's just, I think students are, you know, there's sensitivity, rightfully so, at higher ed expense. And it's expensive to go over there. You get a lot more people can do it if it's a semester. I know there's arguments that, hey, you need a full year to make it happen, really kind of immerse. There's a lot of homestays now. A lot of people staying with Italian families. But the facility is awesome. I mean, the dean is incredible. He's super connected. And we're like one of three programs that are in the old city. I mean, like, the dean's like knows the mayor of Florence and the owner of Fiorentina, like, personally, kind of thing.
Are they trying to, like, kind of reduce the party culture a little bit, it sounds like, with the homestead stuff?
Yeah. I think they've done that, actually. And it's probably been that way for some time. Not that I'm sure it's still going on to some extent, but it's a very different attitude, I think. Okay. So,
yeah. I mean, it makes sense.
I'll be the first to say, kind of, when I, you know, I was a student towards the end of the party years, it maybe a little out of control at times. So,
my class was, I'm not going to tell any stories, but my, like, I had a ton of friends over there, and they had a fun time.
Yeah. Pretty crazy. Yeah. So we're excited, but, okay. So tell me a little bit now. You're working at Pi, you're doing the Pi stuff. You got a couple other gigs too, right? Are you doing some speaking?
And I taught at MSU for a while.
Okay. Awesome.
I taught writing. Like business writing, sort of, like, you know, professional emails, resume creation, all that kind of stuff, which I enjoyed, I was young when I was doing it. So I did it maybe 08, 09 era. And I loved it. I thought it was really fun. I enjoyed interacting with the students. Grading the papers was a little hard, but I loved being in front of the classroom, which I think led us to doing a lot more training work in our current business. And then I do like speaking gigs at law firms and conferences and things like that from time to time.
Yeah, the best way to learn something is teach it, I feel like, right? You got the pressure of being the expert, so you got to make it happen.
Yes, and writing in particular, like, I think many of us are fearful of writing, and so, like, going up there and teaching writing, like, I spent a lot of time that summer learning, like, revisiting grammar.
Right.
I mean, Catholic schools are focused on grammar, which is a good 100%. Thing. Like, I still felt the need to go refresh my memory on grammar. At St. Pat's, you'll love this story. I had horrible penmanship, still do.
Yeah, me too.
So just terrible penmanship. And so Sister Reginald of Mary wouldn't let me be in band, and she made me sit in the coat closet and practice my handwriting.
Wow.
But Mr. Pearson, who you remember from prep days probably, was actually teaching at St. Pat's then. And he was sort of in charge of looking after me. And he was like, this is lame. I'm just going to teach you how to juggle. And so we would be in the coat closet, just like he was just teaching me how to juggle. He's like, he was essentially right. He was like, you're going to type everything. You really don't need to have good cursive. What does it matter? Let's do some juggling. And it was like, it was a great experience, actually.
Oh, that's awesome.
Going anyway, so.
But your handwriting still sucks. But it doesn't matter. So what the heck?
It doesn't matter. That's right. Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah, I hear more and more from professionals the importance of writing, and the ability to communicate, right? And I guess that could be presenting, writing, and whether it's an email or I guess whatever else we write. But
I couldn't agree more. I want to say we did a program that we reported back to MSU on a number of years ago, where we brought together people who were in HR and learning and development program, like, at big companies. And they said exactly that, like, the technical skills are rock solid, but, like, the ability to communicate. And they told one story about an MSU accountant person who spent like 2 straight days on a spreadsheet because they were scared to ask for help. And it was something that someone like you with experience would have been able to help them through in 5 minutes. And so all the hard work in the world doesn't replace just being able to communicate effectively with colleagues, written, speaking, all the above.
100%. Gosh, I can't. That's just a budget blower, right? When you have someone spinning their wheels for that long.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, I literally had a partner at a firm. I won't say which firm because I don't know if he wants me to or wants that out there. But he was like, give me an accounting minor and an English major. I almost prefer that right? Because that's how important being able to communicate effectively is. So, but now at some point you went back to Gonzaga. You got an MBA.
Yes,
that's what kind of ties you into the Gonzaga community. So, what point was that?
I don't remember exactly what 2017 maybe is when I started doing. I did the like while working pretty slow process of it.
Right.
I had to go to Gonzaga to stay in my family. I'm joking. Yeah. Like everybody in my in-laws, like my father-in-law, my mother-in-law, my grandfather-in-law, they all went to Gonzaga. Amy went to Gonzaga in Florence. Her brother went to Gonzaga. Like it is very much a Gonzaga family. And I loved my experience at prep and I love the Jesuit tradition of education. I'm not actually a very religious person, but I think Jesuit education is fantastic. I love the way they do it. I love the ethics class in the MBA program. I can't think of the guy's name who does it, but I loved his class. And it's not the kind of class you get everywhere in the world, but I think that they are interesting questions. The other thing that was just so stunning to me is like, we all have our undergraduate experiences, whatever they are, but like, people love going to Gonzaga. Like all the, there were a few people in my program who were kind of fresh out of school people. And they were like, I'm just doing this program because I want to stay at GU another year. Like, and they called it GUtopia. And I'm like, wow. People are really drinking the Kool-Aid about this school. And I think with good reason. It's an awesome place to go to school, but I was surprised by how much and how emphatic they were about their love for Gonzaga.
That's good to hear. GUtopia, I haven't heard that before.
Isn't that great?
It makes sense. Yeah, yeah. I mean, great community. And it's, I always say, because you'll get comments like that, the product that comes out of there is exceptional. And I'm like, it's not us. We get good, for whatever reason, we attract good students at the end of the day. And it's fun. It's my job's fun. I'll say that much. Yeah. But okay, so now you're fully accepted into the in-law family here. And give me an idea. So I know you're setting up I guess in your given day, you're doing a podcast like today, you're setting up these community events for clients, doing some speaking, getting out and about. What else you got going on? Give me your typical day in the office. And I know there's probably no typical day, but what else?
Yeah, no typical day, but most of my time is spent. So I do a lot of the consultative work, the like training programs. So like, as an example, we'll go to a big law firm and we will do a new partner program about business development. And so basically I'll go in and I will interview the 20 or so people who have just become partners about where they are with their business development journey. And so a lot of my time is spent interviewing those kinds of people. And then sort of like you probably coming up with a curriculum to deliver to them based on what they've told me. So I don't do a ton of the actual roundtables. I am doing one today, but I don't typically do a ton of the roundtable work. I do more of the consulting work. And then I think we tend to get roundtables off of that training work as a mechanism to basically just enable their business development strategy. But most of my day is spent thinking about how to help people come up with a better structure, system, incentive, outreach, collateral, whatever it is, like a better approach to business development. It's one of the most fascinating things. And I'm going to make a plug for you all putting a business development course in your law school and your MBA program. I did take persuasion from Chris Stevens and was a fantastic class. I loved that class. But I was talking the other day to this guy, I have his name written down for us, Paul Grabowski. He works at a firm called Bracewell in Texas. And he teaches a strictly business development course to the law school at the University of Houston. And what's amazing about all of this is so many attorneys become amazing attorneys and they get into their big law career. And 4 or 5 years down the road, they go, oh no, I have to be a salesperson.
Right.
The actual job is growing the firm. Like to be really successful as a partner, I have to build a pyramid of work below me for associates to do so that we can get operational leverage on this business. It's actually not complex. It's the business of law. But learning the law is so interesting and fascinating that we spend so much time, to your point earlier, on the technical element of it in torts that we actually aren't totally prepared to run the business of law when we get out there. And it's not a Gonzaga thing. It's everywhere. And one of the biggest problems is no student wants to sign up for sales class. It feels beneath them in that context, right? They're learning all this cool stuff, a sales class feels like, why wouldn't I have just been a marketing major like Parks, waste my time doing that? But I actually think it's really important.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, and I wouldn't limit it to law, and I know you're not limiting it to law. I mean, dentists. My brother was a dentist. He went to dental school, and he was like, "There's not. I mean, not even like a business course. Like, what is accounting? What is this? How does this work? Even, you know, beyond your sales." But I'm going to make a bold statement here. I kind of feel like, and I'm going to consider you the expert in this field. The higher you move up, the more important, I think, in any industry sales becomes. I feel like the people at the top need to sell, right?
Yes.
They need to, yeah.
The only distinction I might draw is like in a consumer product business, like a Verizon, the lowest person on the totem pole sells at the consumer endpoint. So when it's B2C, a lot of times the sales are transferred to someone who's not that senior. But I'll tell you, like, I did this, I think I can tell this story because he's retired. I did this chief operating officer meeting like in the 2009 era, like during the financial crisis. And it's the chief operating officer from the biggest companies you can imagine. And I will never forget that the COO of Marriott, his name was Bill Shaw. I looked down at him, in his hand, he's got a piece of paper with all the people he needs to talk to because he wants hotel contracts with all of these big companies for their traveling executives. And he's on the mission. Sales is not beneath him at all. He's developing relationships and trying to understand what their needs are for their hotel strategy or whatever. He has a plan in his hand that he's going to do. So you are right, too, that at the top, big sales happen. Like someone is selling a big Verizon deal to Cisco Systems or whatever to do their cell phone service.
Wow.
But we hate it. And I also think a big part of this is there are all these kind of corny sayings about sales that make us feel like, you know, I can sell a ketchup popsicle to a woman in white gloves. And there is this implication of an asymmetry of information and that you are taking advantage of the consumer. Like you're getting over on them. I can sell furnaces in the Mojave or whatever.
Right.
It's a wholly inappropriate lens from which to view business development. Like I always joke when I do trainings at law firms that like you're a doctor on a plane. You're not an ambulance chaser. You're the ambulance. You actually have the solution to these people's problem. They need your help, actually. And of course, it's tongue in cheek, but you have to get people over the hump of not feeling like they're a salesperson, but just feeling like they're helping clients out.
Right, right. A mutual benefit, right? As in pay one way, but you solve a problem. I mean, like anything, I guess, anything we consume for the most part.
I also think there's a big change in sales, like the asymmetry of information that used to exist, like if you go out and buy a car at Larry H. Miller or whatever, you actually know more about the model you want now than the salesperson because you have spent your time online looking at the features, what the options are, how much they cost. They can't possibly commit to memory every option for every car they're selling. And so the internet has helped us eliminate the asymmetry of information in sales that used to exist.
Right, right. Yeah, interesting. You just think of like a Zillow on real estate, right? I mean, you know, all the data's there that you need.
Exactly.
And the comp.
We are more informed consumers than we even deserve to be, I feel like.
Interesting. Interesting. So, okay, so you're working through your MBA, and Steverson's the ethics guy.
Steverson. Yeah. He's great.
Yeah, he's absolutely fantastic. And his spouse, Adrian Lighthouser, also teaches, but she teaches more of the undergrad.
Gotcha.
Okay, so you're working through the MBA. You're taking the part time working, going to classes in the evening, have some, I'm assuming you graduate, and then at some point soon after, you're buying the company out, or there's some transition in pie.
Yeah, I think the buyout may have happened before I finished my MBA. I'm not sure. We had been working on it for like 10 years. Like we had been trying to make this happen. It was we could do another podcast on founder mentality and the way that founders just sort of behave and the way they put value on the things they've created can just be a tough nut to crack sometimes.
Yeah.
So we buy the business out. Interestingly, like we are just a learning organization. Like our company has a huge emphasis on learning. Our founder was an English PhD. He taught at American University. Most of us have education in our backgrounds in some small way. And so I didn't really go to like a lot of people go to an MBA for a reason, like to get a promotion, to get more money. And none of those things were true for me. I just went because I thought it would be interesting. And I do envision myself teaching at some point later in my career. And so I'm like, I should get a terminal degree, although I don't know if y'all call an MBA a terminal degree, but it gives you the right to teach a little more, I think, in some places. And so that was really kind of, I was just like curious about what it would be like. And then that's sort of why I did it.
That's awesome. Yeah, they certainly value education in education, right? So typically to teach, if you wanted to teach a graduate class, you'd have to at least have a graduate degree in that area.
Yeah.
So you're all set, man. You just let me know when you're ready, and we'll bring it on over. So, yeah. you mentioned Stephen Covey earlier. Now, you got the signed book. Do you still reach out to him? Are you still in contact with him?
Unfortunately, he's dead. I know a bunch of the people over at Franklin Covey, and so I still talk to some people. But I mean, I think if I misquote this, we can edit it or whatever, but I think Stephen Covey had begin with the end in mind. That was one of his things. And I love that thesis for a business, like begin with the end in mind.
100%. Wow. And that pretty much guides all your decisions moving forward, right? If you keep that, your eye on the ball.
Exactly.
Am I right? He's the Seven Habits author, right?
Yes. Seven Habits. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned a couple other books. If there were one book you were going to recommend to a business person, what is it? Other than your own books.
Well, so my favorite business book is Michael Lewis's first book. What is it called? Liar's Poker. It's not really like a practical business book. It's a story. I think he's a wonderful writer. So I just love that story. If you're trying to tempt someone to be interested in business, it's sort of a good book. I mean, the purpose of the book is to sort of mock the way that finance was working in the 80s and the sort of greed, but the terminology, it sort of gets you in the place of business, and it's a fascinating read. In our world of professional services, there's one book that's the book of all books, and it's called The Trusted Advisor by David Meister and Charlie Green. And it's the book. And it's unbelievably good. If you want to learn about how to run a law firm, a consulting firm, that kind of firm, and they have written books about this. And I think his book is the best.
Interesting. And you talk about telling a story. I mean, I feel a lot of, like when I'm in class, I'm really just telling a story. Or if someone calls me and I get random calls on random tax stuff. A lot of the times you're telling a story to convey the concepts and what's going on. And, you know, for me in the tax world, why is this rule here? What's the background? What was going on? What's the government trying to do? Or how much of what you do you think is telling a story? And then I'm going to segue into your book, which I imagine has some story. I don't know, but
I think everything is storytelling. It's so much of the advice that we give to people about business development is don't say, I can fix that problem for you, but say, you know, we worked with a similar company in this space and here's how it went down. People can make themselves the center of a story. And it doesn't feel like selling. So I think that is incredibly important. This woman called Kendra Hall wrote an unbelievable book on storytelling. And she has like the four types of stories, and I'm not going to be able to remember them, but the four types of stories that really resonate in business. And it's like the founder story, the profit story, the mission story, I think. And then there's one more. But I think storytelling is incredibly important and underutilized in our businesses. Our chairman, who used to run North America for Accenture and was a McKinsey partner, he does a full class, like an hour class on storytelling that is incredibly powerful. But I think it's so important and underutilized.
Yeah. I mean, I think I almost feel like it's the difference maker between, you know, mid-level to the top, right? If you can tell a good story and sell it. And so let's talk a little bit about your book here. And is it your first book?
Nope, second book. So we did a book. The firm has done a couple of books. So we did this. I didn't do the book, but I did the research for the book. The first one was called How Clients Buy.
Okay.
And one of our clients at IBM, this book was basically about how do you get new customers in professional services. Our client at IBM called us and said, congratulations, you guys wrote the wrong book. that book is great, but we need a book about cross-selling. Like, if we could just have more projects with the clients we currently have, we would never need to get another client. What we can't figure out is the inner workings of cross-selling. And so we did another book called Never Say Sell, where we unpacked, and I wrote this one with my boss, Tom, what cross-selling should look like and what the problems are with cross-selling in a professional services firm. And so that book is out. You can buy it anywhere, or if someone wants one, I'll just mail them a copy. And then the next book we're doing, which we're kind of in a tug of war with Wiley, the publisher, on what we're going to call it. We wanted to call it The Infinite Rolodex. And they did a little survey in their office, and 40% of the people had never heard of a Rolodex, which was humiliating and frustrating to hear. Yeah. And so we're in the process of coming up with a new title, but basically what it is it's a book about managing a growth function in a professional services firm. So you get the job, you're going to lead growth. What are you going to do to make sure you have everybody on board, metrics in place, you're evaluating ROI of investments, incentives are ideal, all those kinds of things. That's what this book will be.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. My Rolodex is my LinkedIn, basically. When I need to find someone, I'm like, well, am I connected with you? So,
but you know what a Rolodex is.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I'm blown away that people don't know what a Rolodex is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like business cards. I think they're going to be out of.
I only use business cards in the Southeast.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. In the Southeast, they'll do the business card thing. Like, they walk into a meeting and they hand you a business card, but nowhere else in the country do I see business cards.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I have a stack that I've had for 10 years just sitting there.
Yep.
Giving out three of them, but interesting. Can you talk a little bit about what is cross-selling? What's the kind of the thesis in that second book? I'm kind of curious as how, and then I'm going to ask the cynical question of a consumer, if I'm seeking consulting services, I guess my accounting mindset is one of, I go, I get services, problem fixed, we move on, right? Which is a real recipe for disaster in business. But I'm going to ask that as the cynic when it comes to cross-selling. So talk to me about cross-selling.
Yeah, so I mean, cross-selling, the book is called Never Say Sell for a reason, because I think cross-selling gives the impression, again, of asymmetry of information, try to go out there and force projects on your clients. And that's not really what it means. I'll just start with why it's hard. Like, it seems like it should be easy, right? You're at Deloitte, you're doing great work for a client. They're going to give me more work, right? If I'm doing great work, why aren't they going to give me more work?
Yeah.
There are all these kinds of bizarre institutional barriers that exist. So in your client, that person may view Andrew as the secret sauce. Like, my tax returns are done a week early, and I'm not really hoping to share this with Frank down the road, because this efficiency is getting me promoted. So there's career risk to you getting another contract, right? Inside the firm itself, when you're at Deloitte and you're trying to sell a different service, so let's say you're doing the tax work for ExxonMobil and it's going great. And the guy from the strategy practice calls you and goes, hey, I got a strategy idea about taking ExxonMobil into EVs. And you go, how about I'm paying for my kids' college with this relationship doing their taxes? How about you just stay away from me? Yeah. I did an interview for the book, and I won't name the firm or the person, but they told me a story where they had a good idea for a strategy project with a client that had a big existing IT project. And the case person for the IT project offered to pay the strategy person the proposed commission to get them out of their hair.
Wow.
Leave me alone. I'll pay you your commission. Get out of my client. So there's this inner working of difficulty that happens. And then you get to credit problem, right? So we all want to win work for the firm, and we all get compensated to grow the business, right? A new piece of work gets sold. And I'm not sure if you get to go to Africa on your Florence trip, but we call this, there's an animal down on the Serengeti, and every single person comes out of their office and goes, I went to prep school with him. I sent him an email. I met him at a conference. And before you know it, everybody's trying to get credit and money for this sale, which becomes a problem. And right. So over time, it builds a culture of just serve your client well, stay in your silo, and just deliver the work that you can deliver. Going back to the Lewis book, don't invite any other risk into this equation. Just protect the risk and enjoy the upside that you already have. And so the book is about how do you solve these very much cultural challenges, not like what are the techniques to reach out and sell something, but how do you create structure and incentive? So like one example in that book is firms started doing this thing called the collaboration tax, where like I keep using Deloitte because you work there. But if you're at Deloitte and you sell a project by yourself, you might only be eligible for 80 business development credits, we'll call them. But if you and I do it together and there are multiple service offerings, we're both eligible for 100. So there's a penalty for going it alone. And firms are toying with all kinds of things. We saw one firm actually pre-COVID restructure their office because this business unit wasn't talking to this business unit and it made tons of sense for them to go to market together. So like there are little things you can do like that, like just make people bump into each other in the halls. And that will naturally create cross-selling because it's our world is trust and credibility. That's it. Trust that like, I think of trust as like, would you leave me with your kids? I'm a good person. That's trust. And credibility is like, can you do the tax return? Do you actually have the expertise to do this?
Right. I hear a lot of talk of past due time to revamp business model. Now I'm thinking of law and accounting firms of we reward inputs, billable hours instead of output. And being that you're working with a lot of, I mean, probably a wide variety of businesses, even beyond that structure, what are you seeing on that front? Is there any evolution of things? And I think of my experience, both maybe as a consumer of those products and as a provider, I get the frustration of the billable hour on both sides, right?
Totally. Yes. It's not like one of the things we write about is like aligned incentive curves. Is like, how do you, as a provider, how do you invert your incentive curve to match the client's incentive curve? Because me getting more hours is not helping the client. Structurally, though, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff coming into play. It does feel like traditionally this business model has been a little bit of an unfunded pension liability where all the partners enjoy a very profitable retirement. And that starts to hang pretty heavy over the business. And you add that to the equation that I think increasingly people are seeing the value in equity. And we see people like Mark Zuckerberg become a billionaire because of equity, not because of hard work over 30 years. And so some firms, I think, are moving toward different business models. So they're taking private equity money. You're seeing a lot of companies take private equity money, buy out that top layer of ex-partners and lean in more to like an equity strategy where they're trying to build enterprise value, which I think gets away from the billable hour requirement. You start to think about value pricing, EBITDA production, all those kinds of things that more traditional businesses think about. And then an interesting one, BDO, the accounting firm, they're like a top 10 size firm. Yeah. They took private equity money and they went as an ESOP though.
Right.
And I'm paying close attention to how that all shakes out. But I think that's probably a good strategy. And I don't know the inner working of how they've structured that deal. There's a lot you can do with an ESOP. But I think that increasingly private equity is coming into our space, which I also think is on some level a negative for business development, because private equity comes in from product companies, SaaS companies, technology companies, and they want to apply kind of like a digital outreach sales approach to professional services. And it's really hard to be successful with kind of AI outbound, if that makes sense. Like there are tools out there like outreach.io that will automate your outreach, but it doesn't work quite as well in our space as it might in selling a product where someone actually has a felt need for that product.
That's interesting. Yeah. And I wonder, I mean, two firms that I'm aware of, Baker Tilly and BDO, have engaged different private equity. At least those are two in the top 10 space. We're seeing it even at smaller firms.
They're rolling them. It's a roll up.
Yeah. I mean,
I think roll-ups are way harder than people like. I feel like roll-up was the term du jour of the past 7 or 8 years. And I think feedback from the people I talk to in private equity is, oh my God, roll-ups are hard. It's a cool buzzword, but if you roll them up too quickly, you miss a ton of the integration value, the synergy value, and it's really hard to do it. I think roll-ups are going to be less in favor. But I do think if you're buying a market or a group of customers, Like if you're just buying a small firm, if Baker Tilly's buying a small firm in the Southeast that has a customer set they can't get to, and they can just bring over the EBITDA in an accretive way. Like if the EBITDA is accretive, I don't know. That seems like a really good strategy to me.
Yeah. Now, how do you, and it's not, I mean, I'm hearing like insurance firms getting private equity moving into a lot of places. How do you, so let's say we do that, you know, and we'll just take Baker Tilly. They're buying a firm in the Southeast. There's going to be some cultural differences. So what are your, what's your steps to kind of smooth that transition? I imagine you're going to anticipate a certain level of client and employee attrition. I mean, you can't nail everything 100%, but what's the approach when you do that?
So you're right. I think there's actually a decent amount of energy put toward change management and the cultural side of it. What's interesting is I think they fall down on like systems. So they don't do a good enough job going, oh my gosh, they have a completely different system and their data is not going to integrate. Like the CIO is not involved enough at the table to go, we can't integrate them. And the cost of getting their data into our system and actually providing them the kind of service is going to be really difficult. So they miss that. I think that they miss kind of the administrative functions. What does marketing do? What does operations do? What does the general counsel do? How are we going to create synergy in those positions? I think they miss that a lot. I do think they pay good attention, though, to like making sure people feel comfortable. And perhaps more importantly than that, identifying the can't lose people and engaging them in the leadership team right away. The other thing is, I think you need to move fast on becoming one firm. Like you remember, you're old enough to remember the AOL Time Warner merger. Oh, yeah. And like, I have interviewed a number of people from that era who say that like 2 years into that, they were still like, that's a Time Warner person. Wow. Like they just never became one company. And I think the faster you can break the eggs, get the people off the ship who aren't going to stay and become one firm, the better off you are. But it's really hard to make that leap.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially when you're a big size, like in our example, Baker Tilly, picking up a 100-person firm, totally different mindset. But it's happened. We are very curious to see how things roll out too with private equity. You know, others. We're watching closely.
Space where the regulation changes and law firms can merge with accounting firms.
I know.
Which would be a wild change.
Totally. Well, so one of the things, working in international tax, right? We're talking to the, you know, the folks in Amsterdam at Deloitte, and depending on the jurisdiction, they do have that combination more or less anymore. Yeah, in some totally. Areas throughout yeah. the world. So, yeah, I think the legal profession here has intentionally, at least historically, has some barriers to entry that might currently inhibit that. But
I think they're good. I think they're actually good, but I don't think they're going to last. Capital sort of wins out every time.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, so it's funny in the CPA profession, and of course, let me go back to CPAs as always because it's so fascinating, but for me at least. And there's a shortage of CPAs, and there's various reasons why people aren't, but there's an increase of hiring into, you know, tech people, MIS folks, yep. People from various backgrounds that can do, like you said, smart people working hard can do the job, not eligible to take a CPA exam. Currently, most states, I think you have to have a majority CPA owner on over 50% or, yep. or more to be a CPA firm. I just wonder if stuff like that's going to change, right? Where
I think it will.
I mean, it's fascinating stuff for sure. But what now? And your third book's coming out here. When's it out? You know,
so it'll probably be out early 2025.
Early 2025.
Okay. They won't hear this, but we always joke that we get 4 months to write it and they get 7 months to print it.
Sure. Yeah. They got to copy edit and other things for sure. So, and can you expound a little bit about what's the thesis of that? I know you kind of gave us a little background, but if you want to.
Yeah. How do you, if you're in charge of creating growth for a professional services firm, this is what you should do. And it's sort of like a maturity curve book. So like entrepreneurial looks like this and world-class looks like this. And we're trying to give people this is what the best firms look like when they're doing it well. And we're trying to do it honestly, agnostic of size. The biggest firms aren't necessarily the best at all of these things. Like there's this firm called IDEO, which is basically an innovation firm. And I think that they are the best at many things and they're pretty small.
Interesting. Yeah. And some level of universal applicability. I mean, I'm sure some of the details change, but I mean, the business is pretty simple, right? Whether you're selling lemonade out on the street or, you know, right. CEO of Microsoft, right. you got revenue, you got expenses, make it happen.
That's
cool, man. Well, I tell you what, I wish I could talk to you for another hour. I want to be respectful of your time. This is actually really fascinating for me. As always, with our close here, what advice would you give to a newly minted Gonzaga MBA grad or even undergrad if you wanted to, as they're about to embark on this incredible journey of a career in business?
Yeah, so if I could give advice to people who are getting their MBA, like the one lesson I learned would be lean into the people in your class. Like make friends, make professional relationships, get to know the people in your classes because they are all the future leaders that you're going to want to connect with. And the, like the word network gives me kind of an icky feeling. But I think you should try to get to know your classmates because those relationships are invaluable. And then the advice I would give after you graduate is to just approach everything with curiosity. If I could figure out how to hire for curiosity, I would take all of them. But like being curious about business, asking a bunch of questions, if you're early in your career, that is what you should be doing, taking in as much as you possibly can, because one, it's going to make you a better professional, but it's also going to help you understand what you like doing and what you don't like doing and give you some direction for your career when I think it can be kind of hard to know what we want to do coming out of school.
Sage advice, for sure. When you're talking about MBA and why you do an MBA, a lot of people do an MBA, to use the bad word, it's really a networking opportunity on some level, right? And that makes perfect sense to what you're saying as far as getting to know people and being a part of the community, being helpful, that's rewarding in and of its own. So,
and it's a Jesuit thing, like it's a Jesuit philosophy, be helpful, be kind, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then how much more you can learn from others, right? It's just kind of this. The snowballing effect. So, well, that's cool, man. I appreciate it. Great to see you.
Great to see you at Twin Lakes.
I'm glad we ran into each other, guys. It's only been 20 years or something like that. So I didn't get to talk to James, but that was my first time out to that place. It was cool. It was really
good
cool. So, yeah, my aunt and uncle got a place in the trailer hood up on the hill. But I was like, God, this is a pretty good deal.
It's a very modest second home.
Yeah, for what you're paying for it and the access and, you know, all these nice Canadians are around. So, yeah, good, man. All right, well, you keep on keeping on.
Thanks, man. Take care. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Those eggs.
Yeah, those eggs.
See you, man.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business. It was edited by yours truly, Margie Allgaard. Go forth and set the world on fire, and go Zags.